This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Hey, welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Roddinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thank you for joining us again, talking politics this week, our favorite thing. Brandon, so much to talk about, so much has happened. God, where to start?
How about some name calling?
Yeah, a little name calling. The weather's getting, shall we say, a little stormy out there.
Oh, wow.
Well, the President of the United States, Brandon, has decided to go on the offensive. A defamation case against him was dismissed. And in response, in classic Donald J. Trump fashion, he started after the folks involved, referred to the plaintiff Stormy Daniels, who allegedly had an affair with him, as horseface, and went after her and his lawyer. Brandon, what are we going to make of this? This continuing erosion of sort of political discourse.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen this before from the president, and without question, it's beyond unacceptable that this would happen. It is, I think, generally unacceptable, but for it to come from the White House, from the president, is beyond unacceptable. I fear the lasting damage of this to the White House and to the credibility of the presidency. I mean, look, there's not only evidence that he had an affair with this woman and that he paid to cover it all up, but now he's like in a Twitter war with an adult film star. Like, what would Grover Cleveland think of this, right? It doesn't hardly resemble the institution that it was designed to be.
I mean, it's humorous to me because it wasn't that long ago that we were arguing about Obama wearing a tan suit,
right,
somehow diminishing the presidency.
Scandal.
Exactly. So it's gotten to a point now where anything he does,
yeah,
the bar continuously gets lower and lower and lower, because I can't imagine a situation in any president of any era, you name it, from George Washington to Barack Obama, where this kind of behavior would ever be tolerated. You didn't get a single response from a member of Congress on the Republican side critical of this.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask about, and that's like the political effect of this. I mean, we've seen the president do this so many times. It seems like the effect is virtually minimal at this point. I mean, his partisans are pretty rock solid behind him. I think, though, that the complication could come in terms of the election, and that's the gender gap, which seems to be like as big as the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
So that's
growing,
I think,
every
be.
Day, seemingly.
Maybe permanently. I don't know if it'll last, if it's durable beyond the cycle, but for sure it's going to be important in this cycle. And every district which has got any sliver of suburban America is going to be potentially in play as a result.
Well, that's not the only news we've got going on in terms of just sort of weird and wild and wacky,
yeah,
kind of stuff. Senator Elizabeth Warren, I guess not content with just letting the midterms play it out, decided to essentially kind of, I guess, announce she was going to be running for president de facto, at least,
yeah,
by releasing, I think ill-advised is probably a nice way of putting it, a DNA test that supports the notion that she has, I think, at some point within the last eight generations of her family, some Native American. To, I guess, quell this narrative that's out there that she has embellished her family history.
Yeah, and there's no win from this, right? Because like the Cherokee Nation has basically said, just because you have some of this ancestry doesn't mean that you're sort of part of this nation. And so there's really no win for her politically, right? The worst part to me is that she's legitimizing the kind of racialized Trump attack that was leveled against her. If she let it alone, then it just makes him look bad, right, in the absence of that. But the fact that she had to sort of, you know, get down to the dirt to try to fight out this battle is, I think, certainly, as you say, ill-advised, but also just legitimizes what the president has been doing.
Right. It kind of reminds me a little bit of when President Obama released his birth certificate,
yeah,
almost like playing to the sort of the tinfoil silly conspiracy theory that, yeah, was out there that he was somehow not really born in the U.S.
It's also kind of, Donald Trump,
also,
right?
Donald Trump, right? So it's the same kind of thing. Yeah, she, I think, was fooled into thinking this would sort of make it go away, or that she was going to sort of, you know, kind of show him. I don't think he did anything other than play the game that he likes to play, which is we talk about these side issues and we ignore sort of substantive policy things, and it has, I think, a negative effect. The dumbest thing to me about this, Brandon, is if you were a Democrat in office, why would you want to be talking about something that's related to 2020 and not about the midterms.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that's right. Hey, speaking of shocking, we've got some really shocking news. There is a murder of a journalist named Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate, and it is like an Agatha Christie novel in terms of its interactions and just the number of people involved and like the effect of what this might have on the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia. So what is happening here? Let's kind of break it down.
Sure. Jamal Khashoggi is a celebrated journalist who is a legal resident of the United States. He has a green card here in the United States and has been a fierce critic of authoritarian regimes throughout the Arab world, but specifically has called into question some of the practices that have gone on in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. In a visit to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, he went in and never came out. It was like, not to make light, because it's serious, kind of a Hotel California deal.
Yeah.
He walked in and
just disappears.
It disappears.
Yeah.
And what seems to be the case is that he was murdered, tortured. In some cases, I think the reports are that he may have been dismembered. It's truly tragic and horrific. And the response from the Saudi government has been mixed at best. The United States is taking kind of this left-right approach where you're seeing a situation where the president is in some ways, I think, making excuses for the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. And it's resulted in this situation where the global community is condemning the actions of Saudi Arabia for something that's pretty outrageous.
Yeah, the link is that American intelligence officials are increasingly beginning to believe that the crown prince is essentially culpable in the killing of this individual. And so this poses real problems for the White House, right? I mean, there are obvious financial connections between Saudi Arabia and the U.S., and this is really the kind of big dollar price tag on this. Now, the question for the U.S. is whether or not Mike Pompeo and the president are willing to kind of push aside some of that to be able to get a full and fair investigation of this, because the murder of a person in this capacity is obviously problematic. But we're talking about a high-profile journalist for the Washington Post who had written critical stories of this government. This is something which definitely has to be considered and thought through. These are the kind of trade-offs that have to be dealt with when you're dealing with a kind of unsavory regime. So I don't know how they're going to deal with this, but they cannot let this pass. And I think that ultimately it's going to have some serious effect on the relations with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I mean, we've got critical relationship with Saudi Arabia, with Turkey.
Turkey, yeah.
And obviously, you know, the energy element here in play, oil and gas, the markets themselves could be destabilized on an economic level if there's sort of bilateral issues. Saudi Arabia is threatened to kind of retaliate if people impose sanctions against them. This is a major international and global crisis, and the question is kind of how the Trump administration is going to approach it. Yeah. We know that the economic component is a significant factor, and frankly, this is the one area that the Trump administration has been touting as we in the run-up to the midterms, but the news isn't entirely rosy here, Brandon. Yes, we've had record unemployment rates in terms of being historically low. GDP growth is at an all-time high. Wages are going up. But all of this is happening with skyrocketing and ballooning deficits. The deficit just jumped 17%. The CBO is reporting it's almost entirely as a result of the multi-trillion dollar tax cuts that just were passed. We've got growth, we've got jobs, but we are paying for it with a pretty big hot check right now.
Yeah. Well, Donald Trump, as you recall, dubbed himself the king of debt. So he is not concerned about this, I think,
Brandon, he filed bankruptcy three times, right. And that's not really an option for the United States of America.
Can America do that?
No,
right?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. But politically, that's our question. And remember Dick Cheney saying that Ronald Reagan essentially allowed for deficits not to matter politically, right? He said famously, deficits don't matter. So I'm not convinced that Republican voters are that worried about this. The fact that the economy is good, I think, is probably enough of a shield for them. Now, the Republicans of, you know, 20 years ago may have been more worried about it. And there are clearly some who are financially conservative enough to be worried. But I don't think that the new Republican Party under the kind of leadership of Donald Trump is really that concerned about it.
I don't think deficits have mattered since Dwight Eisenhower was president. He's the only one who seemed to care about it, right?
Yeah.
Because whether it's a Democrat being critical of Republicans or Republicans being critical of Democrats, depending on who the party in power is, the other side says deficits are really important.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the political saliency here. For the president, though, I mean, he runs the risk of, if there's any downturn in the economy, there's no real tools left in sort of the fiscal toolbox to try to right the ship. You can't cut taxes anymore. You can't spend any more than you already are. But I think the larger issue here for the president is it's running to exactly the way he wants right now. He's got people distracted on these other issues. Yeah. He's got a strong economy. And Democrats, I think, are falling into this trap where they're not talking about the things that work for them. Immigration, healthcare.
Yeah.
Those are the issues they need to be focused on, but they're getting caught up in these other things.
Well, and you know, I think Donald Trump, you know, could get some, you know, credit for doing some good things on the economy, but I don't think he really has. Now, he suggested that he's going to come out with what he calls his nickel plan, where he's asked cabinet officials to essentially cut 5% in their next year's expected budget. So there's an ability for him to be able to, you know, pander to the economic crowd and then maybe take some credit for having cut it. But I think you're right that if the economy is going well and people feel it in their pocketbooks, then the deficit is not something that's going to be critical. Hey, let's talk Houston. We are definitely privileged here to have all kinds of competitive races. We'll talk about in a minute that the president is going to be here in Houston writ large. But we also have visitors from all over the political spectrum, Jay.
Yes, none other than celebrated lawyer Michael Avenatti. I decided to pay a visit to our fair city in Houston and did a fundraising event for the Harris County Democratic Party. Michael Avenatti, you know, to me, I don't know what your opinion is on it. My whole view is the guy is no different than like Larry Flynn was in the 90s, right?
Oh, okay.
He's exposing a bunch of stuff. He's not a real political player. I am dumbfounded that people take him seriously from a political perspective. Because, frankly, other than representing Stormy Daniels and taking down the president's personal counsel, the fact that this guy has been to Iowa and is now touting himself as a potential presidential candidate seems just ludicrous to me.
Well, Ted Cruz called him the presumptive Democratic nominee for president.
Well, I'm sure Ted Cruz did that.
Which they would love, right? Because he's as flamboyant on the left as Trump is on the right. So I've seen a lot of people refer to him as like the Democratic Donald Trump. I'm not sure that's what the country wants. I mean, that would be escalating this war in a way that I think would be probably difficult for the Democrats to win. Nobody outdoes Trump on this score. So Avenatti will hit back as hard as he gets hit on these things. But I'm not sure politically that's where the party wants to go. So it actually probably could have a negative impact, right, overall. So I'm not really sure this is where the Democrats want to hang their hat.
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody really takes it seriously, the idea of him running for president. But you know what? As long as people want to pay money to come hear him speak and want to donate to the Democratic Party, I'm sure Democrats aren't going to mind.
Yeah.
And you know, you certainly have factions out there that think that the fact that he wants to take the fight to Donald Trump in an aggressive manner as appealing.
Yeah. Well, speaking of fundraising, we have got a tremendous haul from Beto O'Rourke. I think we need to get him like a monocle and a top hat like the Monopoly man so he can, you know, spread around that money. He raised $48 million this quarter. That brings his total to just over $61 million. So this is a tremendous amount of money. Jay, what effect is this going to have on the competitive Senate race? Maybe one of the most competitive Senate races in the country.
Well, Brandon, just to put it in some context here, he raised more money in one quarter than Jeb Bush's entire presidential campaign in 2016.
Right. Please clap. Okay.
Yes.
Please clap.
I mean, I don't think there's anyone that thought that Beto O'Rourke was going to be this sort of fundraising juggernaut.
Yeah.
He's doing it all on small dollar contributions. He doesn't take corporation or PAC money. It's a pretty monumental effort. It is a national fundraising base. He says he's not going to run for president. He'd almost be crazy not to.
These numbers say otherwise.
Yeah,
right?
These numbers say otherwise because his ability to raise money is unlike anything we've seen outside of maybe Barack Obama in 2012, where he was an incumbent president.
Yeah.
So the pace here is just out of this world. The real issue to me is I'm not sure any of it matters because you reach a saturation point, and the way he's raising his money, he's getting him in small dollars. Now, he's come out now with a pretty significant television buy, maybe I think the largest buy of the cycle. We've got less than 20 days left to the election.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's enough. I mean, he may be on pretty much all the time, but I'm not sure that's going to matter. The question is sort of the timing of it, how you use the money. And yes, he has more money than anyone else, but if you take the amount of money he's raised, it's still smaller than the cumulative amount of money that Greg Abbott has, plus Dan Patrick, plus Ted Cruz, and the rest of it. He's having to do it all by himself because he and Justin Nelson are the only two people on the Democratic side who are on statewide television.
Yeah, he's got to soften the ground under Ted Cruz's feet. I think that this money can do that. Now, we had talked early on in this race about how he needed to put up a big number, $45 to $50 million. Well, he's done that. And I think that if the home stretch here, the last couple of weeks, is going to have him on TV all the time, using that to be able to advertise Cruz's unpopular positions on healthcare and potential immigration, I think that's a good way for him to be able to cut that margin. Now, that margin is usually in this 5 to 9, depending on what poll you look at, what day. But I think that's a way for him to be able to cut that difference. And we know that in competitive races like this, that a challenger raising a big amount of money can have a significant effect if the fundamentals are right. Now, in terms of history, we know that this is close to the biggest amount of money that's raised in 2000 in New York, which was the Hillary Clinton race where she ran against Rick Lazio. That was over $100 million. So O'Rourke is smashing these fundraising numbers, but if the fundamentals don't end up changing significantly, then he's going to end up essentially like Rick Lazio, raising a big amount of money but not being able to unseat or undo the trajectory of a candidate in a state that has a lot of voters that favor that party.
When we started this conversation about Beto O'Rourke back when he first announced, mm-hmm. there were three big questions. One, could he raise the money for a competitive race? That's a big check.
Check.
He's not only raised it, he has blown it out of the water. The second, could he get close enough within the last 30 days of an election to keep this race competitive? Check. 5 to 9 points. Mm-hmm. The third is, could he increase turnout enough to turn the structural million vote advantage that Republicans have to make this race one where we don't see it coming, much like Donald Trump won in 2016, to one where he wins? That's the question left.
Question mark.
Will he be able to turn this money into bigger turnouts so we get a number that's closer to 40-45% total vote? We shall see.
That's why these polls are all over the place, because I think no one is quite sure. So he hopes for big numbers. Cruz hopes for small numbers. We'll see. Hey, speaking of big numbers, Jay, we've got the President of the United States coming here to the Lone Star State. He announced that he is going to be holding a rally that is in large part connected to Ted Cruz, but is also clearly related to everybody who is underperforming on the Republican side of the ballot here in Texas. This is more kind of Bob Seger than Beyonce numbers in terms of the total size.
Yeah, I think
it's still a president coming to town for Republican candidates. It's going to draw a crowd.
Yeah. This is not a Beyonce. This is not a Reliant Stadium, NRG
yes.
Stadium. This is that NRG Arena.
Yeah.
Louis C.K. played there. Okay, so let's keep that in context. This is not the largest arena.
As promised, right?
Yes.
8,000-ish, right? So, yeah, that's not so big.
No, that's not so big. But yes, MAGA, the MAGA tour is coming to H-Town. And the big question here is, who will be on the stage with him? We know that Governor Abbott has said he's coming mm-hmm. and will be on there. We know Ted Cruz, obviously, mm-hmm. who this is supposed to be. But Dan Patrick will be there. But the question to me is, you've got John Culberson, a congressman in a tight, tight race in a suburban district here mm-hmm. against Lizzie Fletcher. Is he going to get on that stage? You've got Pete Olson, who is in a suburban district in CD22, in an increasingly competitive race against Sri Kulkarni. Is he going to get on that stage? Dan Crenshaw in CD2, mm-hmm. Running against Todd Litton. Same kind of questions. Do you see the congressional candidates? Do we state representatives? Because we know that the MAGA crowd is not necessarily a Republican crowd.
Yeah.
It's a Donald Trump crowd. And so the question is, does that going to translate over? And who's going to show up?
A lot of those folks on that stage, the hypothetical stage you mentioned, have had problems with Donald Trump. Ted Cruz, of course, among the most visible, but also Dan Crenshaw. So I'm not totally sure that you're going to see that many people, but I think the fact that he's coming here shows that it's not just Cruz. Like, there are a bunch of vulnerable candidates down ballot. Like you say, you've got at least 8 or 9 in the state. You've got 6, 7 congressional candidates at the Democratic side who've outraised their incumbent Republican opponent. So there's a lot of ground to make up in Texas, and the president's presence here could potentially do that. But I'm going to do you one better here, one more log on the fire, and that is that Sean Hannity, right, the pulling out all the stops
the
for
Big
Ted
Sean.
Cruz, is coming here in the days before to rally with Ted Cruz in Beaumont in Houston. So they are making a pretty concerted effort to keep Southeast Texas in the red column.
Because nothing says vote Republican in suburban Texas like Sean Hannity.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about something happening a little bit further down ballot. There's been a bit of a dust-up between Representative Mary Gonzalez from Clint and Representative Pat Fallon from Prosper. What happened, Jay?
Well, I mean, essentially what happened is that Fallon decided to kind of mock her sexual orientation, mm-hmm. sexual identity in a pretty, I think, inappropriate way to
flippant.
A group.
Yeah,
very flippant. He was trying to make a joke. He was speaking to the Wichita County Republican women. That he was sort of making light of it, but trying to bring it out in a context of this sort of larger culture war that's going on, sort of mocking. For anyone who doesn't know, Representative Gonzalez refers to herself as pansexual. And so this turned into a bit of a dust-up. She asked for an apology, and Fallon said that he did call to apologize.
Yeah, and that's good. This is the kind of thing that I know that is not something that representatives should be doing, and it's lamentable, but maybe understandable given the kind of politics that we find ourselves in today. So hopefully this is the end of it.
Well, yeah, and the interesting thing is through the session, these two reps
had
got along great. They're very friendly, and so it's a little bit of shame that the Representative Fallon did that.
Yeah.
Do you know, Brandon, that we might have a Texan running for president of the United States? In fact, he all but announced it.
Right.
Julian Castro, former mayor of San Antonio, former secretary of HUD in the Obama administration, pretty much announced that he was running for president. And my question to you is, who really cares?
Right. Did we not know this already? Like he's going to Iowa because he wants to get, you know, some good frozen custard. No, like you go to Iowa this time of year to be able to generate support. I think it's as good a shot as any. I mean, we know that candidates can come from everywhere. I think that Julian Castro has got a unique perspective. He's young. He's got vision. He's a Latino in a country that's growing much more Latino. So I think the Democrats could do worse. But let's be clear, he's not going to be the only one, right? He's going to be fighting for space in the, you know, in the Holiday Inn in Cedar Rapids with Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and Avenatti and
everybody
else.
Yeah, in fact, he's polling right about what Avenatti is right now and in the
but
way too
are,
early
right?
CNN, right?
Yeah.
1%. Yeah, look, I like Julian Castro fine. I mean, he was actually a pretty good mayor of San Antonio. The city of San Antonio runs a city manager form of government. It's not like he was a strong-handed manager there, and as HUD secretary, I think he did an adequate job. That's not normally a launching pad. He passed on running for governor here in Texas in large part because of this. I just think the prospects of him to me, Julian Castro is running for vice president of the United States.
Interesting.
And he's also running and got started this thing before Beto O'Rourke, I think, emerged on the scene.
Yeah, and showed a pathway to make it look like it could be done.
Yeah, and so I'm not sure if his time isn't past. I think he probably miscalculated a bit, but he's in the race and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, the Democrats in Texas want him back, and so maybe him losing that would be good, but it's going to be a long haul no matter what. And oh my gosh, are we starting 2020 talk already?
We got to finish up 2018.
Yeah, let's do that.
And we've had the big debate, Brandon. Our big convo for today is, of course, unpacking the Beto Cruz tete-a-tete debate and I guess final debate since we don't have any time. My impression on it, Brandon, was just, I think, straight up, Ted Cruz is a tremendous technical debater. He stays on message. He can define what he wants to do. You may not like it, but he's gonna go out there and say it. Beto O'Rourke is unconventional, and he proved that yet again by the strictest rules of bringing up a topic, answering that topic, and staying on message and pivoting against your opponent. Ted Cruz, I think, is really a master at it. Beto O'Rourke, I think he certainly came out as authentic. But Cruz did a great job, I think, defining him. I think he used the word extreme in association with O'Rourke 11 times in the debate. But Beto, this was a different kind of Beto O'Rourke, much more aggressive, called him Lion Ted, the return of Lion Ted. What's your take?
I thought that working backwards, that that point was good, that he needed to kind of soften that ground to blunt the fact that the president's coming, right? And remind people that it wasn't so obvious that these two were, you know, kin. And so I think that's a good sort of effect for O'Rourke, because the Trump bump could be significant going forward, especially given when it's happening. I agree with you. I mean, I think the debate generally wasn't very magnetic on either side. I mean, there's, I think, no way that you can beat Ted Cruz at a debate like this. It doesn't happen. He is just too good. The best stylistic approach that O'Rourke can take is to do this as a guerrilla war instead of a conventional war. And if he gets caught in this conventional warfare, like a debate like that, then he doesn't succeed. So Cruz is much better at it, and I think it definitely showed here. That's not to say that it didn't land a few blows on the O'Rourke side. I mean, he definitely bloodied Cruz's nose a little bit on a couple of issues, right? I think he was able to hit him a little bit on healthcare and maybe on border security, but the difficulty in trying to pin Ted Cruz down when he pivots to stuff like raising taxes and judicial confirmation stuff, which is pretty popular with the Republican base, it's just really hard to find a real avenue there. So on the question about the third debate, let's talk strategy. I don't think O'Rourke needs it. I don't think he wants it. I don't think he needs to be on a stage again with Ted Cruz, who is just going to outrun him again. So why agree to that when you've got $30 million in the bank and you can use that money to advertise and you can continue to rally support, you can continue to get big numbers of crowds and get media attention from that? Why debate if you just are going to fight to a draw, right?
Well, I think format matters. And so the problem with the first two debates is they were traditional podium-style debates.
Right.
Beto O'Rourke is fantastic at town hall settings. The magnetism he has, his natural charisma comes through, and he works better when he interacts with an audience and people. Cruz is much, much better at the sort of standardized form debate where he can, you know, track a particular issue, he can control the dynamic. It's much harder for him, I think, when he has to interact with an audience, and that's where he's much more vulnerable. So, I mean, I can certainly see the argument, or at least the temptation from the O'Rourke folks to say, give us a town hall, let's do this thing together, we'll get a big audience, let's see what happens. But I kind of agree with you. The thing that struck me was that they were both speaking to almost entirely different groups of Texans.
Right.
Ted Cruz is talking almost always exclusively to his base. He wants to remind Republicans, no matter where they are on the spectrum, that Beto O'Rourke on social issues is to the left of where they are. And he's trying to get them to stay home just on that alone. Beto O'Rourke is trying to energize people around ideas. And as it relates to Republicans, he wants to let them know that he is the bipartisan one of the two.
Yeah.
He is not the culture warrior. He's not that guy that wants to sort of make a bright line dividing folks. He's the guy who wants to kind of bring folks together.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference. And so you can do that with TV. You've certainly got the money to do that if you're O'Rourke.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it really works. These debates work for both of them. We're kind of analyzing them a different way.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure it didn't work for both candidates and do exactly what they wanted. Yeah.
So let's break it down here, big picture. I think that, as you say, these debates are about priming the base. But O'Rourke's biggest challenge here is to try to peel off certain kind of core voters from Cruz who are maybe unhappy with him or with Trump. That means especially healthcare, potentially on the cost of border security and the effectiveness of border security. So those are, I think, a kind of swing vote, Republican, traditional voting, women, college-educated voters, suburbanites. That's where he needs to be able to peel off support, because he's going to need a good 10-15% of the electorate to basically switch votes, switch parties. And that's going to be hard to do. These debates can help him do it, but it's better to do it otherwise.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
A big thanks to our coordinating producer and the keeper of our debate prep book, Ernie Manous. Special kudos to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the great debater, Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Runninghouse. We'll see you next week.